This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Artemis Fowl by Owen Colfer. Read for you by Nathaniel Parker.
Prologue. How does one describe Artemis Fowl? Various psychiatrists have tried and failed. The main problem is Artemis's own intelligence. He bamboozles every test thrown at him. He has puzzled the greatest medical minds and sent many of them gibbering to their own hospitals. There is no doubt that Artemis is a child prodigy. But why does someone of such brilliance dedicate himself to criminal activities? This is a question that can be answered by only one person, and he delights in not talking. Perhaps the best way to create an accurate picture of Artemis is to tell the by now famous account of his first villainous venture. I've put together this report from first-hand interviews with the victims, and as the tale unfolds, you will realize that this was not easy. The story began several years ago at the dawn of the 21st century. Artemis Fowl had devised a plan to restore his family's fortune, a plan that could topple civilizations and plunge the planet into a cross-species war. He was 12 years old at the time. Chapter 1. The Book. Ho Chi Minh City in the summer. Sweltering by anyone's standards. Needless to say, Artemis Fowl would not have been willing to put up with such discomfort if something extremely important had not been at stake. Important to the plan. Sun did not suit Artemis. He did not look well in it. Long hours indoors in front of the monitor had bleached the glow from his skin. He was white as a vampire and almost as testy in the light of day. "I hope this isn't another wild goose chase, Butler," he said, his voice soft and clipped, "especially after Cairo." It was a gentle rebuke. They had travelled to Egypt on the word of Butler's informant.
"No, sir. I'm certain this time. Guyan is a good man."
"Hmm," droned Artemis, unconvinced. Passers-by would have been amazed to hear the large Eurasian refer to the boy as Sir. This was, after all, the third millennium. But this was no ordinary relationship, and these were no ordinary tourists. They were sitting outside a curbside cafe on Dong Kai Street, watching the local teenagers circle the square on mopeds. Nguyen was late, and the pathetic patch of shade provided by the umbrella was doing little to improve Artemis's mood. But this was just his daily pessimism. Beneath the sulk was a spark of hope. Could this trip actually yield results? Would they find the book? It was too much to hope for. A waiter scurried to their table.
"More tea, sirs?"
he asked, head bobbing furiously. Artemis sighed. "Spare me the theatrics and sit down." The waiter turned instinctively to Butler, who was, after all, the adult.
"But, sir, I am the waiter."
Artemis tapped the table for attention. "You're wearing handmade loafers, a silk shirt, and 3 gold signet rings. Your English has a tinge of Oxford about it, and your nails have the soft sheen of the recently manicured. You are not a waiter. You are our contact, Nguyen Xuan, and you've adopted this pathetic disguise to discreetly check for weaponry." Nguyen's shoulders sagged.
"It is true. Amazing."
"Hardly. A ragged apron does not a waiter make." Nguyen sat, pouring some mint tea into a tiny china cup. "Let me fill you in on the weapon status," continued Artemis. "I am unarmed, but Butler here, my, Butler, has a Sig Sauer in his shoulder holster, 2 Shrike throwing knives in his boots, a Derringer 2 shot up his sleeve, garrote wire in his watch, and 3 stun grenades concealed in various pockets. Anything else, Butler?"
"The kosh, sir."
"Oh, yes. A good old ball-bearing kosh, stuffed down his shirt." Nguyen brought the cup trembling to his lips.
Don't be alarmed, Mr. Schwann, smiled Artemis. The weapons will not be used on you. Ungayan didn't seem reassured. No, continued Artemis. Butler could kill you 100 different ways without the use of his armory. Though I'm sure one would be quite sufficient. Ungayan was by now thoroughly spooked. Artemis generally had that effect on people. A pale adolescent speaking with the authority and vocabulary of a powerful adult. Ungayan had heard the name Foul before. Who hadn't in the international underworld? But he'd assumed he'd be dealing with Artemis Senior, not this boy, though the word boy hardly seemed to do this gaunt individual justice. And the giant butler. It was obvious that he could snap a man's backbone like a twig with those mammoth hands. Ungayan was starting to think that no amount of money was worth another minute in this strange company.
And now to business, said Artemis, placing a micro-recorder on the table. You answered our web advertisement.
Ungayan nodded, suddenly praying his information was accurate.
Yes, Mr. Master Fowl. What you are looking for? I know where it is.
Really?
And am I supposed to take your word for this? You could be walking me straight into an ambush. My family is not without enemies.
Butler snatched a mosquito out of the air beside his employer's ear.
No, no, said Ungayan, reaching for his wallet. Here, look.
Artemis studied the Polaroid. He willed his heart to maintain a calm beat. It seemed promising, but anything could be faked these days with a PC and flatbed scanner. The picture showed a hand reaching from layered shadows, a mottled green hand.
Hmm, he murmured. Explain. This woman, she is a healer near Todu Street. She works in exchange for rice wine. All the time, drunk.
Artemis nodded. It made sense, the drinking. One of the few consistent facts his research had unearthed. He stood, smoothing the creases from his white polo shirt.
Very well. Lead on, Mr. Ungayan.
Ungayan wiped the sweat from his stringy moustache.
Information only, that was the agreement. I don't want any curses on my head.
Butler expertly gripped the informant behind the neck.
I'm sorry, Mr. Ungayan, but the time when you had a choice in matters is long past.
Butler steered the protesting Vietnamese to a rented four-wheel drive that was hardly necessary on the flat streets of Ho Chi Minh City, or Saigon, as the locals still called it. But Artemis preferred to be as insulated from civilians as possible. The jeep inched forward at a painfully slow rate, made all the more excruciating by the anticipation building in Artemis's chest. He could suppress it no longer. Could they at last be at the end of their quest? After 6 false alarms across 3 continents, could this wine-sodden healer be the gold at the end of the rainbow? Artemis almost chuckled. Gold at the end of the rainbow. He'd made a joke. Now there's something that didn't happen every day. The mopeds parted like fish in a giant shoal. There seemed to be no end to the crowds. Even the alleyways were full to bursting with vendors and hagglers. Cooks dropped fish heads into woks of hissing oil, and urchins threaded their way underfoot, searching for unguarded valuables. Others sat in the shade, wearing out their thumbs on Game Boys. Ungayan was sweating right through his khaki top. It wasn't the humidity, he was used to that. It was this whole cursed situation. He should have known better than to mix magic and crime. He made a silent promise that if he got out of this, he would change his ways. No more answering shady internet requests, and certainly no more consorting with the sons of European crime lords. The jeep could only go so far. Eventually, the side streets grew too narrow for the four-wheel drive. Artemis turned to Ungayan.
It seems we must proceed on foot, Mr. Ungayan. Run, if you like, but expect a sharp and fatal pain between your shoulder blades.
Ungayan glanced into Butler's eyes. They were a deep blue, almost black. There was no mercy in those eyes.
Don't worry, he said. I won't run.
They climbed down from their vehicle. 1,000 suspicious eyes followed their progress along the steaming alley. An unfortunate pickpocket attempted to steal Butler's wallet. The manservant broke the man's fingers without looking down. They were given a wide berth after that. The alley narrowed to a rutted lane,
Sewage and drain pipes fed directly onto the muddy surface. Cripples and beggars huddled on rice mat islands. Most of the residents of this lane had nothing to spare, with the exception of three.
Well? Demanded Artemis. Where is she?
Ngaian jabbed a finger towards a black triangle beneath a rusted fire escape.
There. Under there. She never comes out. Even to buy rice spirits, she sends a runner. Now can I go?
Artemis didn't bother answering. Instead, he picked his way across the puddled lane to the lee of the fire escape. He could discern furtive movements in the shadows.
Butler, can you hand me the goggles?
Butler plucked a set of night vision glasses from his belt and placed them in Artemis's outstretched hand. The focus motor buzzed to suit the light. Artemis fixed the glasses to his face. Everything became radioactive green. Taking a deep breath, he turned his gaze to the squirming shadows. Something squatted on a raffia mat, shifting uneasily in the almost non-existent light. Artemis fine-tuned the focus. The figure was small, abnormally so, and wrapped in a filthy shawl. Empty spirit jugs were half buried in the mud around her. One forearm poked from the material. It seemed green. But then, so did everything else.
Madam, he said, I have a proposition for you.
The figure's head wobbled sleepily.
Wine,
she rasped, her voice like nails on a school board.
Wine, English.
Artemis smiled. The gift of tongues, aversion to light.
Check. Check. Irish, actually. Now, about my proposition.
The healer shook a bony finger craftily.
Wine first, then talk.
Butler.
The bodyguard reached into a pocket and drew out a half pint of the finest Irish whiskey. Artemis took the bottle and held it teasingly beyond the shadows. He barely had time to remove his goggles when the claw-like hand darted from the gloom to snatch the whiskey. A mottled green hand. There was no doubt. Artemis swallowed a triumphant grin.
Pay our friend, Butler, in full. Remember, Mr. Ngaian, this is between us. You don't want Butler to come back, do you?
No, no, Master Fowl. My lips are sealed.
They'd better be, or Butler will seal them permanently.
Ngaian skipped off down the alley so relieved to be alive that he didn't even bother counting the sheaf of U.S. currency, most unlike him. In any event, it was all there. All $20,000. Not bad for half an hour's work. Artemis turned back to the healer.
Now, madam, you have something that I want.
The healer's tongue caught a drop of alcohol at the corner of her mouth.
Yes, Irish. Sore head. Bad tooth. I heal.
Artemis replaced the night vision goggles and squatted to her level.
I'm perfectly healthy, madam, apart from a slight dust mite allergy, and I don't think even you can do anything about that. No, what I want from you is your book.
The hag froze. Bright eyes glinted from beneath the shawl.
Book?
She said cautiously.
I don't know about no book. I am healer. You want book? Go to library.
Artemis sighed with exaggerated patience.
You are no healer. You're a sprite. Pishog, fairy, Cadoolan, whichever language you prefer to use, and I want your book.
For a long moment the creature said nothing. Then she threw back the shawl from her forehead. In the green glow of the night vision goggles, her features leaped at Artemis like a Halloween mask. The fairy's nose was long and hooked under two slitted golden eyes. Her ears were pointed, and the alcohol addiction had melted her skin like putty.
If you know about the book, human,
she said slowly, fighting the numbing effects of the whiskey,
then you know about the magic I have in my fist. I can kill you with a snap of my fingers.
Artemis shrugged. I think not.
Look at you. You're near dead. The rice wine has dulled your senses, reduced to healing warts. Pathetic. I'm here to save you, in return for the book.
What could a human want with our book?
That is no concern of yours. All you need to know are your options. The sprite's pointed ears quivered. Options?
One,
you refuse to give us the book and we go home, leaving you to rot in this sewer.
Yes,
said the fairy.
I choose this option.
Ah, no. Don't be so eager. If we leave without the book, you'll be dead in a day.
A day? A day? The healer laughed. I will outlive you by a century. Even fairies tethered to human realm can survive for ages.
Not with a half pint of holy water inside them, said Artemis, tapping the now empty whiskey bottle. The fairy blanched, then screamed. A high, keening, horrible sound.
Holy water! You have murdered me, human!
True, admitted Artemis. It should start to burn any minute now. The fairy poked her stomach tentatively.
The second option?
Listening now, are we? Very well, then. Option two. You give me the book for 30 minutes only, then I return your magic to you. The sprite's jaw dropped.
Return my magic? Not possible.
Oh, but it is. I have in my possession 2 ampoules. One, a vial of spring water from the fairy well 60 meters below the Ring of Tara, possibly the most magical place on Earth. This will counteract the holy water.
And the other?
The other is a little shot of man-made magic. A virus that feeds on alcohol, mixed with a growth reagent. It will flush every drop of rice wine from your body, remove the dependence, and even bolster your failing liver. It'll be messy, but after a day you'll be zipping around as though you were 1,000 years old again. The sprite licked her lips. To be able to rejoin the people. Tempting.
How do I know to trust you, human? You have tricked me once already.
Good point. Here's the deal. I give you the water on faith. Then, after I've had a look at the book, you get the booster. Take it or leave it. The fairy considered. The pain was already curling around her abdomen. She thrust out her wrist.
I take it.
I thought you might. Butler. The giant manservant unwrapped a soft velcroed case containing a syringe gun and 2 vials. He loaded the clear one, shooting it into the sprite's clammy arm. The fairy stiffened momentarily, and then relaxed.
Strong magic,
she breathed. Yes, but not as strong as your own will be when I give you the second injection. Now, the book. The sprite reached into the folds of her filthy robe, rummaging for an age. Artemis held his breath. This was it. Soon the Fowls would be great again. A new empire would rise, with Artemis Fowl the Second at its head. The fairy woman withdrew a closed fist.
No use to you anyway. Written in the old tongue.
Artemis nodded, not trusting himself to speak. She opened her knobbly fingers. Lying in her palm was a tiny golden volume the size of a matchbox.
Here, human. 30 of your minutes, no more.
Butler took the tiny tome reverentially. The bodyguard activated a compact digital camera and began photographing each wafer-thin page of the book. The process took several minutes. When he was finished, the entire volume was stored on the camera's chip. Artemis preferred not to take chances with information. Airport security equipment had been known to wipe many a vital disk, so he instructed his aide to transfer the file to his portable phone, and from there email it to Fowl Manor in Dublin. Before the 30 minutes were up, the file containing every symbol in the fairy book was sitting safely in the Fowl server. Artemis returned the tiny volume to its owner. Nice doing business with you. The sprite lurched to her knees.
The other potion, human!
Artemis smiled. Oh, yes, the restoring booster. I suppose I did promise.
Yes, human promised.
Very well. But before we administer it, I must warn you that purging is not pleasant. You're not going to enjoy this one bit. The fairy gestured around her at the squalid filth.
You think I enjoy this? I want to fly again.
Butler loaded the second vial, shooting this one straight into the carotid artery. The sprite immediately collapsed on the mat, her entire frame quivering violently. Time to leave, commented Artemis. 100 years of alcohol leaving a body by any means possible is not a pretty sight. The butlers had been serving the Fowls for centuries. It had always been the way. Indeed, there were several eminent linguists of the opinion that this was how the noun originated.
The first record of this unusual arrangement was when Virgil Butler had been contracted as servant, bodyguard, and cook to Lord Hugo de Fole for one of the first great Norman Crusades. At the age of 10, Butler children were sent to a private training centre in Israel, where they were taught the specialised skills necessary to guard the latest in the Fowl line. These skills included cordon bleu cooking, marksmanship, a customised blend of martial arts, emergency medicine, and information technology. If, at the end of their training, there was not a Fowl to guard, then the butlers were eagerly snapped up as bodyguards for various royal personages, generally in Monaco or Saudi Arabia. Once a Fowl and a butler were put together, they were paired for life. It was a demanding job, and lonely, but the rewards were handsome if you survived to enjoy them. If not, then your family received a 6-figure settlement, plus a monthly pension. The current butler had been guarding young Master Artemis for 12 years, since the moment of his birth. And, though they adhered to the age-old formalities, they were much more than master and servant. Artemis was the closest thing Butler had to a friend, and Butler was the closest Artemis had to a father, albeit one who obeyed orders. Butler held his tongue until they were aboard the Heathrow connection from Bangkok. Then he had to ask. Artemis. Artemis looked up from the screen of his power book. He was getting a head start on the translation.
Yes?
The sprite? Why didn't we simply keep the book and leave her to die?
A corpse is evidence, Butler.
My way, the people will have no reason to be suspicious. But the sprite? I hardly think she will confess to showing humans the book. In any case, I mixed a slight amnesiac into her second injection. When she finally wakes up, the last week will be a blur. Butler nodded appreciatively. Always 2 steps ahead, that was Master Artemis. People said he was a chip off the old block. They were wrong. Master Artemis was a brand new block, the likes of which had never been seen before. Doubts assuaged, Butler returned to his copy of Guns and Ammo, leaving his employer to unravel the secrets of the universe.
Chapter 2. Translation.
By now you must have guessed just how far Artemis Fowl was prepared to go in order to achieve his goal. But what exactly was this goal? What outlandish scheme would involve the blackmailing of an alcohol-addicted sprite? The answer was gold. Artemis's search had begun 2 years previously when he first became interested in surfing the internet. He quickly found the more arcane sites, alien abduction, UFO sightings, and the supernatural. But most specifically, the existence of the people. Trawling through gigabytes of data, he found hundreds of references to fairies from nearly every country in the world. Each civilization had its own term for the people, but they were undoubtedly members of the same hidden family. Several stories mentioned a book carried by each fairy. It was their Bible, containing, as it allegedly did, the history of their race and the commandments that governed their extended lives. Of course, this book was written in Gnomish, the fairy text, and would be of no use to any human. Artemis believed that with today's technology, the book could be translated, and with this translation, you could begin to exploit a whole new group of creatures. Know thine enemy was Artemis's motto, so he immersed himself in the lore of the people until he had compiled a huge database on their characteristics. But it wasn't enough, so Artemis put out a call on the web. Irish businessmen will pay large amount of US dollars to meet a fairy, sprite, leprechaun, pixie. The responses had been mostly fraudulent, but Ho Chi Minh City had paid off. Artemis was perhaps the only person alive who could take full advantage of his recent acquisition. He still retained a childlike belief in magic, tempered by an adult determination to exploit it. If there was anybody capable of relieving the fairies of some of their magical gold, it was Artemis Fowl II.
It was early morning before they reached Fowl Manor. Artemis was anxious to bring up the file on his computer, but first he decided to call in on Mother. Angeline Fowl was bedridden. She had been since her husband's disappearance. Nervous tension, the physician said. Nothing for it but rest and sleeping pills. That was almost a year ago. Butler's little sister, Juliet, was sitting at the foot of the stairs. Her gaze was boring a hole in the wall. Even the glitter mascara couldn't soften her expression. Artemis had seen that look already, just before Juliet had suplexed a particularly cheeky pizza boy. The suplex, Artemis gathered, was a wrestling move. An unusual obsession for a teenage girl, but then again she was, after all, a butler. Problems, Juliet? Juliet straightened hurriedly.
My own fault, Artemis. Apparently I left a gap in the curtains. Mrs. Fowl couldn't sleep.
Muttered Artemis, scaling the oak staircase slowly. He worried about his mother's condition. She hadn't seen the light of day in a long time now. Then again, should she miraculously recover, emerging revitalized from her bedchamber, it would signal the end of Artemis's own extraordinary freedom. It would be back off to school, and no more spearheading criminal enterprises for you, my lad. He knocked gently on the arched double doors.
Mother, are you awake?
Something smashed against the other side of the door. It sounded expensive.
Of course I'm awake. How can I sleep in this blinding glare?
Artemis ventured inside. An antique four-poster bed threw shadowy spires in the darkness, and a pale sliver of light poked through a gap in the velvet curtains. Angeline Fowl sat hunched on the bed, her pale limbs glowing white in the gloom.
Artemis, darling, where have you been?
Artemis sighed. She recognized him. That was a good sign.
School trip, Mother. Skiing in Austria.
Ah, skiing, crooned Angeline. How I miss it.
Maybe when your father returns.
Artemis felt a lump in his throat, most uncharacteristic.
Yes, perhaps when father returns. Darling, could you close those wretched curtains? The light is intolerable.
Of course, Mother. Artemis felt his way across the room, wary of the low-level clothes chests scattered about the floor. Finally, his fingers curled around the velvet drapes. For a moment, he was tempted to throw them wide open. Then he sighed and closed the gap.
Thank you, darling. By the way, we really have to get rid of that maid. She's good for absolutely nothing.
Artemis held his tongue. Juliet had been a hard-working and loyal member of the Fowl household for the past 3 years. Time to use Mother's absent-mindedness to his advantage.
You're right, of course, Mother. I've been meaning to do it for some time. Butler has a sister, I believe, would be perfect for the position. I think I've mentioned her. Juliet?
Angeline frowned.
Juliet, yes. The name does seem familiar. Well, anyone would be better than that silly girl we have now. When can she start?
Straight away. I'll have Butler fetch her from the lodge.
You're a good boy, Artemis. Now give Mummy a hug.
Artemis stepped into the shadowy folds of his mother's robe. She smelled perfumed like petals in water, but her arms were cold and weak.
Oh, darling, she whispered,
and the sound sent goosebumps popping down Artemis's neck.
I hear things at night. They crawl along the pillow and into my ears.
Artemis felt that lump in his throat again.
Perhaps we should open the curtains, Mother.
No, his mother sobbed, releasing him from her grasp.
No, because then I could see them too.
Mother, please. But it was no use. Angeline was gone. She crawled to the far corner of the bed, pulling the quilt under her chin.
Send the new girl.
Yes, Mother.
Send her with cucumber slices and water.
Yes, Mother. Angeline glared at him with crafty eyes.
And stop calling me Mother. I don't know who you are, but you're certainly not my little Artie.
Artemis blinked back a few rebellious tears.
Of course. Sorry, sorry. Don't come back here again, or I'll have my husband take care of you. He's a very important man, you know.
Very well, Mrs. Fowl. This is the last you'll see of me.
It had better be.
Angeline froze suddenly.
Do you hear them?
Artemis shook his head.
No, I don't hear any...
They're coming for me! They're everywhere!
Angeline dived for cover beneath the bedclothes. Artemis could still hear her terrified sobs as he descended the marble staircase. The book was proving far more stubborn than Artemis had anticipated. It seemed to be almost actively resisting him. No matter which program he ran it through, the computer came up blank. Artemis hard-copied every page, tacking them to the walls of his study. Sometimes it helped to have things on paper. The script was like nothing he'd seen before, and yet it was strangely familiar. Obviously, a mixture of symbolic and character-based language, the text meandered around the page in no apparent order. What the program needed was some frame of reference, some central point on which to build. He separated all the characters and ran comparisons with English, Chinese, Greek, Arabic, and Cyrillic texts, even with Ogham. Nothing. Moody with frustration, Artemis sent Juliet scurrying when she interrupted with sandwiches, and moved on to symbols. The most frequently recurring pictogram was a small male figure. Male, he presumed, though with the limited knowledge of the fairy anatomy, he supposed it could be female. A thought struck him. Artemis opened the ancient languages file on his power translator and selected Egyptian. At last, a hit. The male symbol was remarkably similar to the Anubis god representation on Tutankhamun's inner chamber hieroglyphics. This was consistent with his other findings. The first written human stories were about fairies, suggesting that their civilization predated man's own. It would seem that the Egyptians had simply adapted an existing scripture to suit their needs. There were other resemblances, but the characters were just dissimilar enough to slip through the computer's net. This would have to be done manually. Each gnomish figure had to be enlarged, printed, and then compared with the hieroglyphics. Artemis felt the excitement of success thumping inside his ribcage. Almost every fairy pictogram or letter had an Egyptian counterpart. Most were universal, such as the sun or birds. But some seemed exclusively supernatural and had to be tailored to fit. The Anubis figure, for example, would make no sense as a dog god, so Artemis altered it to read King of the Fairies. By midnight, Artemis had successfully fed his findings into the Macintosh. All he had to do now was press decode. He did so. What emerged was a long, intricate string of meaningless gibberish. A normal child would have abandoned the task long since. The average adult would probably have been reduced to slapping the keyboard. But not Artemis. This book was testing him, and he would not allow it to win. The letters were right, he was certain of it. It was just the order that was wrong. Rubbing the sleep from his eyes, Artemis glared at the pages again. Each segment was bordered by a solid line. This could represent paragraphs or chapters, but they were not meant to be read in the usual left-to-right, top-to-bottom fashion. Artemis experimented. He tried the Arabic, right-to-left, and the Chinese, columns. Nothing worked. Then he noticed that each page had one thing in common, a central section. The other pictograms were arranged around this pivotal area, so a central starting point, perhaps. But where to go from there? Artemis scanned the pages for some other common factor. After several minutes, he found it. There was on each page a tiny spearhead in the corner of one section. Could this be an arrow? A direction? Go this way. So the theory would be start in the middle, then follow the arrow reading in spirals. The computer program wasn't built to handle something like this, so Artemis had to improvise. With a craft knife and ruler, he dissected the first page of the book and reassembled it in the traditional Western languages order, left to right, parallel rows. Then he re-scanned the page and fed it through the modified Egyptian translator. The computer hummed and whirred, converting all the information to binary. Several times it stopped to ask for confirmation of a character or symbol. This happened less and less as the machine learned the new language. Eventually, two words flashed on the screen. File converted. Fingers shaking from exhaustion and excitement, Artemis clicked print.
A single page scrolled from the laser writer. It was in English now. Yes, there were mistakes, some fine-tuning needed, but it was perfectly legible and, more importantly, perfectly understandable. Fully aware that he was probably the first human in several thousand years to decode the magical words, Artemis switched on his desk light and began to read. The Book of the People, being instructions to our magics and life rules. Carry me always, carry me well. I am thy teacher of herb and spell. I am thy link to power arcane. Forget me, and thy magic shall wane. 10 times 10 commandments there be. They will answer every mystery. Cures, curses, alchemy. These secrets shall be thine through me. But, fairy, remember this above all. I am not for those in mud that crawl. And forever doomed shall be the one who betrays my secrets one by one. Artemis could hear the blood pumping in his ears. He had them. They would be as ants beneath his feet. Their every secret would be laid bare by technology. Suddenly the exhaustion claimed him and he sank back in his chair. There was so much yet to complete. 43 pages to be translated, for a start. He pressed the intercom button that linked him to speakers all over the house. Butler, get Juliet and come up here. There are some jigsaws I need you to assemble. Perhaps a little family history would be useful at this point. The Fowls were, indeed, legendary criminals. For generations they had skirmished on the wrong side of the law, hoarding enough funds to become legitimate. Of course, once they were legitimate, they found it not to their liking, and returned almost immediately to crime. It was Artemis I, our subject's father, who had thrown the family fortune into jeopardy. With the breakup of communist Russia, Artemis Sr. had decided to invest a huge chunk of the Fowl fortune in establishing new shipping lines to the vast continent. New consumers, he reasoned, would need new consumer goods. The Russian mafia did not take too kindly to a Westerner muscling in on their market, and so decided to send a little message. This message took the form of a stolen Stinger missile launched at the Fowl Star on her way past Murmansk. Artemis Sr. was on board the ship, along with Butler's uncle, and 250,000 cans of cola. It was quite an explosion. The Fowls were not left destitute, far from it, but billionaire status was no longer theirs. Artemis II vowed to remedy this. He would restore the family fortune, and he would do it in his own unique fashion. Once the book was translated, Artemis could begin planning in earnest. He already knew what the ultimate goal was. Now he could figure out how to achieve it. Gold, of course, was the objective, the acquisition of gold. It seemed that the people were almost as fond of the precious metal as humans. Each fairy had its own cache, but not for much longer if Artemis had his way. There would be at least one of the fairy folk wandering around with empty pockets by the time he'd finished. After 18 solid hours of sleep and a light continental breakfast, Artemis climbed to the study that he had inherited from his father. It was a traditional enough room, dark oak and floor-to-ceiling shelving. But Artemis had jammed it with the latest computer technology, a series of networked Apple Macs whirred from various corners of the room. One was running CNN's website through a DAT projector, throwing oversized current affairs images against the back wall. Butler was already there, firing up the hard drives. Shut them all down, except the book. I need quiet for this. The manservant started. The CNN site had been running for almost a year. Artemis was convinced that news of his father's rescue would come from there. Shutting it down meant that he was finally letting go. All of them. Artemis glanced at the back wall for a moment. Yes, he said finally. All of them. Butler took the liberty of patting his employer gently on the shoulder. Just once, before returning to work. Artemis cracked his knuckles. Time to do what he did best. Plot dastardly acts.
Chapter 3. Holly. Holly Short was lying in bed, having a silent fume. Nothing unusual about this. Leprechauns in general were not known for their geniality, but Holly was in an exceptionally bad mood, even for a fairy. Technically, she was an elf, fairy being a general term. She was a leprechaun too, but that was just a job. Perhaps a description would be more helpful than a lecture on fairy genealogy. Holly Short had nut-brown skin, cropped auburn hair, and hazel eyes. Her nose had a hook, and her mouth was plump and cherubic, which was appropriate considering that Cupid was her great-grandfather. Her mother was a European elf, with a fiery temper and a willowy figure. Holly, too, had a slim frame, with long, tapered fingers perfect for wrapping around a buzz button. Her ears, of course, were pointed. At exactly 1 meter in height, Holly was only a centimeter below the fairy average. But even 1 centimeter can make an awful lot of difference when you don't have many to spare. Commander Root was the cause of Holly's distress. Root had been on Holly's case since day one. The commander had decided to take offense at the fact that the first female officer in Recon's history had been assigned to his squad. Recon was a notoriously dangerous posting with a high fatality rate, and Root didn't think it was any place for a girlie. Well, he was just going to have to get used to the idea because Holly Short had no intention of quitting for him or anybody else. Though she'd never admit it, another possible cause for Holly's irritability was the ritual. She'd been meaning to perform it for several moons now, but somehow there just never seemed to be time. And if Root found out she was running low on magic, she'd be transferred to traffic for sure. Holly rolled off her futon and stumbled into the shower. That was one advantage of living near the Earth's core. The water was always hot. No natural light, of course, but that was a small price to pay for privacy. Underground. The last human-free zone. There was nothing like coming home after a long day on the job, switching off your shield and sinking into a bubbling slime pool. Bliss. The fairy suited up, zipping the dull green jumpsuit up to her chin and strapping on her helmet. Lep Recon uniforms were smart these days, not like the top-of-the-morning costume the Force had had to wear back in the old days, buckled shoes and knickerbockers. Honestly, no wonder leprechauns were such ridiculous figures in human folklore. Still, probably better that way. If the Mud People knew that the word leprechaun actually originated from Lep Recon, an elite branch of the Lower Elements Police, they'd probably take steps to stamp them out. Better to stay inconspicuous and let the humans have their stereotypes. With the moon already rising on the surface, there was no time for a proper breakfast. Holly grabbed the remains of a nettle smoothie from the cooler and drank it in the tunnels. As usual, there was chaos in the main thoroughfare. Airborne sprites jammed the avenue like stones in a bottle. The gnomes weren't helping either, lumbering along with their big swinging behinds blocking two lanes. Swear toads infested every damp patch, cursing like sailors. That particular breed began as a joke but had multiplied into an epidemic. Someone lost their wand over that one. Holly battled through the crowds to the police station. There was already a riot outside Spud's Spud Emporium. Lep, Corporal Newt, was trying to sort it out. Good luck to him. Nightmare. At least Holly got the chance to work above ground. The Lep station doors were crammed with protesters. The goblin dwarf turf war had flared up again, and every morning hordes of angry parents showed up demanding the release of their innocent offspring. Holly snorted. If there actually was an innocent goblin, Holly Short had yet to meet him. They were clogging up the cells now, howling gang chants and hurling fireballs at each other. Holly shouldered her way into the throng. "Coming through," she grunted. "Police business." They were on her like flies on a stinkworm.
"My grandpa is innocent. Police brutality! Officer, could you take my baby in his blankie? He can't sleep without it."
Holly set her visor to reflect and ignored them all. Once upon a time, the uniform would have earned you some respect. Not anymore. Now you were a target.
"Excuse me, officer, but I seem to have misplaced my jar of warts. Pardon me, young elf, but my cat's climbed a stalactite," or, "If you have a minute, Captain, could you tell me how to get to the Fountain of Youth?"
Holly shuddered. Tourists. She had troubles of her own, more than she knew, as she was about to find out. In the station lobby, a kleptomaniac dwarf was busy picking the pockets of everyone else in the booking line, including the officer he was handcuffed to. Holly gave him a swipe in the backside with her buzz baton. The electric charge singed the seat of his leather trousers.
"What you doing there, Mulch?"
Mulch started, contraband dropping from his sleeves.
"Officer Short,"
he whined, his face a mask of regret.
"I can't help myself, it's my nature."
"I know that, Mulch. It's our nature to throw you in a cell for a couple of centuries." She winked at the dwarf's arresting officer. "Nice to see you're staying alert." The elf blushed, kneeling to pick up his wallet and badge. Holly forged past Root's office, hoping she would make it to her cubicle before...
"Short! Get in here!"
Holly sighed. "Oh, well, here we go again." Stowing her helmet under her arm, Holly smoothed the creases from her uniform and stepped into Commander Root's office. Root's face was purple with rage. This was, more or less, his general state of existence, a fact that earned him the nickname Beach Root. There was an office pool running on how long he had before his heart exploded. The smart money was on half a century at the outside. Commander Root was tapping the moonometer on his wrist.
"Well," he demanded, "what time do you call this?"
Holly could feel her own face colouring. She was barely a minute late. There were at least a dozen officers on this shift who hadn't even reported in yet, but Root always singled her out for persecution.
"The thoroughfare," she mumbled, lamely. "There were four lanes down."
"Don't insult me with your excuses," roared the commander. "You know what the city centre is like. Get up a few minutes earlier."
It was true. She did know what Haven was like. Holly Short was a city elf born and bred. Since the humans began experimenting with mineral drilling, more and more fairies had been driven out of the shallow forts and into the depth and security of Haven City. The metropolis was overcrowded and underserviced, and now there was a lobby to allow automobiles in the pedestrianized city centre. As if the place wasn't smelly enough already, with all those country gnomes lumbering around the place. Root was right. She should get up a bit earlier. But she wouldn't. Not until everybody else was forced to.
"I know what you're thinking," said Root. "Why am I picking on you every day? Why don't I have a ball out those other layabouts?"
Holly said nothing, but agreement was written all over her face.
"I'll tell you why, shall I?"
Holly risked a nod.
"It's because you're a girl."
Holly felt her fingers curl into fists. She knew it.
"But not for the reasons you think," continued Root. "You're the first girl in Recon, ever. You're a test case, a beacon. There are a million fairies out there watching your every move. There are a lot of hopes riding on you, but there's a lot of prejudice against you, too. The future of law enforcement is in your hands, and at the moment I'd say it was a little heavy."
Holly blinked. Root had never said anything like this before. Usually it was just,
"Fix your helmet, stand up straight, blah, blah, blah." "You have to be the best you can be, Short, and that has to be better than anybody else."
Root sighed, sinking into his swivel chair.
"I don't know, Holly, ever since that Hamburg affair."
Holly winced. The Hamburg affair had been a total disaster. One of her perps had skipped out to the surface and tried to bargain with the mud people for asylum. Root had to stop time, call in the retrieval squad, and do four memory wipes. A lot of police time wasted. All her fault. The commander took a form from his desk.
"It's no use, I've made up my mind. I'm putting you on traffic and bringing in Corporal Frond."
"Frond?" exploded Holly. "She's a bimbo, an airhead. You can't make her a test case."
Root's face turned an even deeper shade of purple.
"I can and I will. Why shouldn't I? You've never given me your best. Either that or your best just isn't good enough. Sorry, Short, you had your chance."
The commander turned back to his paperwork. The meeting was over. Holly could only stand there, aghast. She'd blown it. The best career opportunity she was ever likely to get, and she'd tossed it in the gutter. One mistake and her future was past. It wasn't fair. Holly felt an uncharacteristic anger take hold of her, but she swallowed it. This was no time to lose her temper. "Commander Root, sir, I feel I deserve one more chance." Root didn't even look up from the paperwork.
"And why's that?"
Holly took a deep breath.
"Because of my record, sir. It speaks for itself, apart from the Hamburg thing. 10 successful recons, not a single memory wipe or time stop, apart from
the Hamburg thing,"
completed Root.
Holly took a chance. If I were a male, one of your precious sprites, we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
Root glanced up sharply.
Now, just a minute, Captain Short.
He was interrupted by the bleeping of one of the phones on his desk. Then two, then three. A giant viewscreen crackled into life on the wall behind him. Root jabbed the speaker button, putting all the callers on conference.
Yes?
We've got a runner.
Root nodded.
Anything on Scopes?
Scopes was the shop name for the shrouded trackers attached to American communications satellites.
Yep, said caller two. Big blip in Europe. Southern Italy. No shield.
Root cursed. An unshielded fairy could be seen by mortal eyes. That wasn't so bad if the perp was humanoid.
Classification?
Bad news, Commander, said the third caller. We got us a rogue troll.
Root rubbed his eyes. Why did these things always happen on his watch? Holly could understand his frustration. Trolls were the meanest of the deep tunnel creatures. They wandered the labyrinth, preying on anything unlucky enough to cross their path. Their tiny brains had no room for rules or restraint. Occasionally, one found its way into the shaft of a pressure elevator. Usually, the concentrated air current fried them, but sometimes one survived and was blasted to the surface. Driven crazy by pain and even the tiniest amount of light, they would generally proceed to destroy everything in their path. Root shook his head rapidly, recovering himself.
Okay, Captain Short. Looks like you get your chance. You're running hot, I take it?
Yes, sir,
lied Holly, all too aware that Root would suspend her immediately if he knew she'd neglected the ritual.
Good. Then sign yourself out a sidearm and proceed to the target area.
Holly glanced at the viewscreen. Scopes were sending high-res shots of an Italian fortified town. A red dot was moving rapidly through the countryside towards the human population.
Do a thorough reconnaissance report in. Do not attempt a retrieval. Is that understood?
Yes, sir.
We lost 6 men to troll attacks last quarter. 6 men. That was below ground in familiar territory.
I understand, sir.
Root pursed his lips doubtfully.
Do you understand, Short? Do you really?
I think so, sir.
Have you ever seen what a troll can do to flesh and bone?
No, sir. Not up close.
Good. Let's not make today your first time.
Understood.
Root glared at her.
I don't know why it is, Captain Short, but whenever you start agreeing with me, I get decidedly nervous.
Root was right to be nervous. If he'd known how this straightforward recon assignment was going to turn out, he would probably have retired there and then. Tonight, history was going to be made. And it wasn't the discovery of radium, first man on the moon, happy kind of history. It was the Spanish Inquisition, here comes the Hindenburg, bad kind of history. Bad for humans and fairies. Bad for everyone. Holly proceeded directly to the chutes. Her normally chatty mouth was a grim slash of determination. One chance, that was it. She would allow nothing to break her concentration. There was the usual queue of holiday visa hopefuls stretching to the corner of Elevator Plaza, but Holly bypassed it by waving her badge at the waiting line. A truculent gnome refused to yield.
How come you lep guys get to go topside? What's so special about you?
Holly breathed deeply through her nose. Courtesy at all times.
Police business, sir. Now if you could just excuse me.
The gnome scratched his massive behind.
I hear you lep guys make up your police business just to get a look at some moonlight. That's what I hear.
Holly attempted an amused smile. What actually formed on her lips resembled a lemon-sucking grimace.
Whoever told you that is an idiot, sir. Recon venture only above ground when absolutely necessary.
The gnome frowned. Obviously he had made up the rumour himself, and suspected that Holly might have just called him an idiot. By the time he'd figured it out, she had skipped through the double doors. Foley was waiting for her in ops. Foley was a paranoid centaur, convinced that human intelligence agencies were monitoring his transport and surveillance network. To prevent them reading his mind, he wore a tinfoil hat at all times. He glanced up sharply when Holly entered through the pneumatic double doors.
Anybody see you come in here?
Holly thought about it.
The FBI, CIA, NSA, DEA, MI6, oh, and the EIB.
Foley frowned.
The EIB?
Everyone in the building, smirked Holly. Foley rose from his swivel chair and clip-clopped over to her.
Oh, you're very funny, Short. A regular riot. I thought the Hamburg affair might have knocked some of the cockiness out of you. If I were you, I'd concentrate on the job in hand.
Holly composed herself. He was right. Okay, Foley, fill me in. The Centaur pointed to a live feed from the Eurosat, which was displayed on a large plasma screen.
This red dot is the troll. He's moving towards Martina Franca, a fortified town near the city of Brindisi. As far as we can tell, he stumbled into vent E7. It was on a cool-down after a surface shot. That's why the troll isn't crispy barbecue right now.
Holly grimaced. Charming, she thought.
We've been lucky in that our target has bumped into some food along the way. He chewed on a couple of cows for an hour or two, so that bought us a bit of time.
A couple of cows? Exclaimed Holly. Just how big is this fellow? Foley adjusted his foil bonnet.
Bull troll. Fully grown. 180 kilos with tusks like a wild boar. A really wild boar.
Holly swallowed. Suddenly recon seemed a much better job than retrieval.
Right. What have you got for me?
Foley cantered across to the equipment table. He selected what looked like a rectangular wristwatch.
Locator. You find him, we find you. Routine stuff.
Video? The Centaur clipped a small cylinder into the accommodating groove on Holly's helmet.
Live feed, nuclear battery. No time limit. The mic is voice activated.
Good, said Holly.
Root said I should take a weapon on this one, just in case. Way ahead of ya, said Foley.
He picked a platinum handgun from the pile. A Neutrino 2000. The latest model.
Even the tunnel gangs don't have these. Free settings, if you don't mind. Scorched, well done, and crisped to a cinder.
Nuclear power source too, so plug away. This baby will outlive you by 1,000 years.
Holly strapped the lightweight weapon into her shoulder holster.
I'm ready, I think.
Foley chuckled. I doubt it. No one's ever really ready for a troll.
Thanks for the confidence, Booster.
Confidence is ignorance, advised the Centaur. If you're feeling cocky, it's because there's something you don't know.
Holly thought about arguing, but didn't. Maybe it was because she had a sneaking suspicion that Foley was right. The pressure elevators were powered by gaseous columns vented from the Earth's core. The LepTech boys, under Foley's guidance, had fashioned titanium eggs that could ride on the currents. They had their own independent motors, but for an express ride to the surface there was nothing like the blast from a tidal flare. Foley led her past a long line of chute bays to E7. The pod sat in its clamp, looking very fragile to be rocketing about on magma streams. Its underside was charred black and pockmarked from shrapnel. The Centaur slapped it fondly on a fender.
This baby's been in service for 50 years. Our oldest model still in the chutes.
Holly swallowed. The chutes made her nervous enough without riding in an antique.
When does it come offline?
Foley scratched his hairy belly. Well, the fun in the way it is, not until we have us a fatality. Holly cranked open the heavy door, the rubber seal yielding with a hiss. The pod was not built for comfort. There was barely enough space for a restraining seat among the jumble of electronics.
What's that?
Asked Holly, pointing at a greyish stain on the seat's headrest. Foley shuffled uncomfortably.
Brain fluid, I think. We had a pressure leak on the last mission. But that's plugged now, and the officer lived. Down a few IQ points, but alive, and he can still take liquids.
Well, that's all right then, quipped Holly, threading her way through the mass of wires. Foley strapped the harness onto her, checking the restraints thoroughly.
All set?
Holly nodded.
Foley tapped her helmet mic. Keep in touch, he said, pulling the door behind him.
Don't think about it, Holly told herself. Don't think about the white-hot magma flow that's going to engulf this tiny craft. Don't think about hurtling towards the surface with a Mach 2 force trying to turn you inside out. And certainly don't think about the blood-crazed troll ready to disembowel you with his tusks. Nope, don't think about any of that stuff.
Too late.
Foley's voice sounded in her earpiece.
T-20, he said. We're on a secure channel in case the mud people have started underground monitoring. You never know. An oil tanker from the Middle East intercepted a transmission one time. What a mess that was.
Holly adjusted her helmet mic.
Focus, Foley. My life is in your hands here.
Okay, sorry.
We're going to use the rail to drop you into E7's main shaft. There's a surge due any minute. That should see you pass the first 100 clicks,